If you use the internet on a daily basis, and chances are you do, you probably don't put much thought into cybersecurity. You know, your network connections, the pages you visit, the files you download. You should be thinking about these all the time. Welcome to And Security for All. Your host is Kim Hakem. We're here to help you understand, in general terms, how and why your cybersecurity should be kept in check. Now, here is Kim Hakem.
Hello and welcome to And Security for All. I'm Omar Bedran, sitting in for Kim Hakem. And I have a guest today. Jonathan Kimmett is going to be joining us today. I think he's been here before, and we are pleased to have him. Thank you so much, Jonathan, for joining us.
Absolutely. I'm really excited to be here. This is, I love doing the show. I love hosting it. I love, you know, doing it with Kim, but I'm really excited to be here with you, Omar. I've watched your shows and, you know, the guests that you have. So we get to cross paths and officially do one together.
All right. Well, I definitely appreciate it. I mean, cybersecurity is top of mind for almost everybody all the time, even if they don't want it. And so it's important. We need to get to it, even though we have a lot of other things happening right now. So, I mean, let's talk about what's really going on. I think that a lot of people have had an interesting week, so to speak.
Yes. Yes.
And so, I mean, let's just jump right into it. Tell me, you know, what happened in your world?
Let's start there. the biggest one was CrowdStrike last week. I can tell you that for us, so for Alias Cybersecurity, the firm I work for, we have clients that are on CrowdStrike. And beginning at, I believe it was our first call came in at like 3:30 in the morning or thereabouts, and we immediately started working with them. You know, we have a 24/7 SOC, so people started getting phone calls, and we had the whole engineering team up and working, and we had clients that had CrowdStrike. They were down. They were getting the blue screens of death. We didn't know what happened. We didn't know what was going on. We had gotten just a little bit of information in, and so we knew kind of what to do or how to bring them back up, but it takes time. Yeah. And our customers, not just ours, but as you know, I met with a lot of people, my VCSO clients, plus our SOC, you know, clients, you know, everyone that we had. And generally speaking, most of the people that I know and I talk to were back up and running by about noon on that day. So it was about 8 hours of effort. We still have clients that have some stranglers, you know, just kind of machines out there. They're either traveling or they're at home or they're in a way that they can't be easily fixed. But from a functional point of view, we believe we're up and running, able to fix the problem. CrowdStrike had some pretty quick information on how to fix it. And so the real key was just getting out there and touching those machines and doing the fix and getting it back up and running.
That's great to hear from your point. Like, I mean, did you see a correlation between like, you know, the people who were suffering a little bit more industry wise?
Yes. And this is just from my point. What I saw was organizations that didn't have the resources. So if they have enough IT people, they took a lot of effort to get back. I don't have to go touch. We had clients. I saw a strong team that either themselves or they had like they were able to people and
it's kind of contrary to like what everything has been going towards, right? Like everybody wants to work from home. Everybody wants to, you know, have like, you know, their own kind of thing, which we've proven to be able to do. But when something like this happens, it really slows things down and makes, you know, the on-prem kind of philosophy come back, right?
Well, absolutely. And I mean, when we're, that's a really good point. You know, when we're talking about a remote work, you had people that their machines were affected because you got to have EDR on the machines. You got to have that endpoint protection. But they may not have had other things such as remote configuration management or remote access to it. They may not have had those extra tools. Again, maybe they were a smaller firm or a smaller organization. They were doing all bring your own device. There may be a lot of different reasons why. So that became a real problem because you can't always have an easy fix for that remote worker. You know, that is just, you got to touch the machine. And so you've got to bring it in somewhere or someone's got to get out to it. So I definitely see that in some cases, a remote environment like that could be much more affected than something where you have a centralized area, centralized resources. I don't think it's any better or worse in terms of the functionality of the organization, but for this particular situation, having to go touch each machine, boot it up in safe mode, delete a file, reboot, all, having access is really important.
Yeah. And so, I mean, have you ever experienced something like this in your organization, like now or, you know, previously or anything like that? That, like, to me, it feels like we haven't had anything like that happen in a long time. But, you know, I'm on the event side. Like I'm having parties and hanging out with like CISOs, you know, like, so tell me how it is more on your side. We're actually, you know, protecting things.
Well, I mean, this actually does happen a lot. I remember, I kind of have this ongoing list, that during this situation that I kind of put together for doing like a LinkedIn article. But I remember back in 2009 to 2010, 2011 timeframe, that McAfee antivirus, which was one of the big names. You had McAfee, you had Symantec, you had Kaspersky. They released a DAT file that saw a particular EXE file, service host EXE, on a Windows box, specifically Windows XP, as a threat and killed it, which Windows operating systems don't like that file being gone or don't like that EXE not being there. So a lot of people were affected by that because anybody that got that DAT file and it ran a scan and it saw service host.exe as a threat and it killed it, it had a problem with the operating systems. And then a few years later, there was there's been releases on iOS 10 that updates will brick them, so brick your phone. There's Android, you know, Samsung released something back a few years ago, 20, let me look at my things, 2019. So Samsung released something that broke Android devices that they managed. I remember that, yeah. Yeah, in 2020, there was one that was just a regular Windows update, but it took Windows servers 2012 and 2016 and put them in a reboot loop. And then in 2022, there was a Mac OS update, Big Sur, that would cause instability issues on the phones and on tablets, and they would crash, they wouldn't reboot. So, I mean, this actually happens a lot.
Yeah. There was a Zoom one too, wasn't there? Like a whenever we were all like high on Zoom, like on 2021, probably. Like I think we all lived on Zoom for you know, a majority of your work life, and and I think that it crashed it, and it made us all feel like the one solution we had,
the one way to communicate with people. Yeah, it's like taking the phone down back in the 80s. You had exactly, nothing after that. Yep. No, I mean, this stuff happens. And here's what I've told people. Software, and this is generally what we're dealing with, is software of some kind. It's written by human beings. and it's not perfect. And there's going to be a vulnerability. There's going to be a mistake. Could there have been more tests on the patch? Well, sure, there could have been. But I have seen software that has been in production for years and a vulnerability is found in it, you know, that just somebody found it. So, you know, I know a lot of people are really harping on CrowdStrike and they're really angry and they're mad and I get it. I understand, but
yeah,
I believe, number one, I told this, I put this on LinkedIn, don't take your EDR off. You know, yes, yeah, it was a problem. Don't take it off because, and what I told this is, if I was an attacker, if I was a bad guy, I would be using this scenario for doing all kinds of attacks because it's good cover.
Yeah.
You know, everyone is focusing on this vulnerability and they're mad at CrowdStrike and they're mad at this thing. But the attackers are like, they're not paying attention. Let me send some spam. Let me send some phishing. Let me send do this. Let me send a worm out. Let me do. And so they could use it as a big cover. So I was telling people, I was like, guys, yes, it sucks. Absolutely. But be careful. Don't turn your EDR off. Don't get so mad at CrowdStrike that you're just yanking it off the system and you're going to go with something else. Let's protect the machines. You know, you still have to make good decisions even during an incident. I think that's really a big issue is when you're doing an incident response, and this absolutely was an incident response, you have to make good decisions. If you make an emotional decision, such as you're mad at CrowdStrike that this happened, well, that's a bad idea. That's going to put you in a bad situation. You're going to put your organization in a bad situation. So this stuff will happen. It's going to happen again. I can guarantee you that probably within the next year, maybe 6 months, maybe next week, I don't know, there will be some patch that comes out for some software, some hardware, something that's going to have an unintended consequence that's going to take something down. You know, I hope and I hope and I hope that it doesn't take any life safety systems down. It doesn't, you know, do anything bad to anything that could cause harm. But there will be other problems. I mean, it's just software. Yeah. It's written by humans.
Yeah, and let's talk about that for a second. Like, when we talk about incident response, I think that a lot of times your brain goes to, you know, like hackers getting into my system, right? Yep. Like trying to take my stuff. But yep. Let's talk about it more like it could actually be like, okay, you know, like motorcycle accident. You think about like, you know, somebody T-boning you. But you could actually just fall down.
Yeah.
You could actually just take off out of your driveway and fall down. And so is this something closer to that? Like, you know, CrowdStrike seems like they kind of stumbled with the update. And is it like a person, you know, or, you know, like a user thing? Or is it really like something that's a little deeper?
Well, I mean, I don't know the full thing. And no one will probably ever know unless you're inside of CrowdStrike. I've heard a lot of things. People have talked about a lot of things. I don't want to speculate, you know, what happened. I know what the fix was. So from that, you can kind of figure out that, well, if this is the thing that was wrong, then coming down the line, you know, that patch or it was a file. I mean, it was a file update. They got on the system that Microsoft didn't like, and it just, you know, it went nuts. So, you know, there was probably, I would hope that there was Q&A on the patch, and there was change management, and there was a process in which something got pushed out, but it was approved. They had tested it to the best that they could. Could they have tested better? Well, yeah, maybe. You know, one of the interesting things that people don't think about on stuff like this is how much resources it takes to do QA and testing. And here's the thing. Here's a good example. If you have called, this might be kind of polarizing, sort of, but we're going to talk about it anyway. Yeah. If you call 911,
yeah,
and you need help, Are you angry when the police officer is driving above the speed limit to get to your house?
Yeah, interesting, yeah.
Now, the person, if they were to T-bone someone, they're going to be really angry, for sure. I understand. But me, if I call 911 and I need them here, you know, whether it be police or ambulance or fire or whatever, and they drive over the speed limit, I'm probably not going to mind that much. So when we're talking about getting patches out or getting upgrades out or getting software deployed or whatever, there is this balance of trying to get things out quickly, getting it through the process and getting a new features put in or whatever it is that is balanced towards, okay, well, let's slow it down. Let's test this. Let's try this. Let's do security testing and whatever. Now, from a security side, we're always fighting that fight. Don't deploy things that you haven't security tested. You haven't looked for vulnerabilities. Absolutely, you haven't pen tested. But there's a balance there. So getting things pushed out quickly and, you know, making sure that it's tested, that where is that fine line? You know, if somebody is needing a patch, but it's held up in red tape because they're doing QA on it, well, who's, I mean, they're mad. They're mad that it's taking a long time to get QA, but then they want to make sure it works. So, yeah. Again, I don't want to speculate on CrowdStrike specifically. Because here's the way I look at it. There was a problem. CrowdStrike was pretty quick to respond to customers saying, we see it's a problem. Here's the fix. Yes, it sucked. And yes, it sucked for the IT teams and the organizations and things, you know, were down and services were down. Absolutely. That was a bad situation. But I don't know for sure, 100%, it could have been avoided, honestly, because I don't know what their QA, I don't know all those pieces. So I don't want to speculate on that because it's not fair to them. I would hope that they have a Q&A, they do test this, that they put reasonable amount of resources into testing it. And if they did and something got through, well, I got through. I mean, no one's perfect. So, you know, even your QA is not perfect. I was talking to someone today, and we're talking about a software program that was still being used that a vulnerability was found, and I think it was from 2008. So the update was pushed out to the software in 2008 that caused the vulnerability, and no one has found it until now. So it happens.
Wow. Yeah. That's so interesting. Yeah, it becomes more and more like biological things, right? I mean, we just, as a nation, went through the world went through this, right? There's vulnerabilities in different things, and sometimes you don't want that update. Let's call it an update. And some people want it, some people don't. But the consequences could be worse, right? Is it fair to say that whatever CrowdStrike was doing might have actually prevented something bigger or something worse from happening to certain organizations?
It could have, sure. I mean, I don't know. But it's possible. One of the things, I will say this, one of the things that it actually came out of it, you kind of mentioned it earlier about incident response. So, that's how I'm actually looking at this. So when you're looking at incident response of a thing. In this particular case, it was you had to go touch all the machines and get it back up. If you had BitLocker, you had to get the BitLocker keys and unlock the machines, boot it in safe mode, and do whatever. So this really was like a fire test of your incident response processes, how fast you were able to do it, what resources did you need to be able to do it, all these different things. So I would say, it, even though this was bad, organizations absolutely lost money. It was a process that took a lot of time, a lot of resources to get into it. I mean, I spent a lot of time with my clients. We spent a lot of time with our SOC clients, all those different things. It wasn't life safety in all cases. Mm-hmm. It wasn't hypercritical in terms of safety things, you know, harm. People would die because of something like this. But it was affecting the organization. So you had to do your best to get things back up and going. And like I said, most organizations, when they started figuring it out, they were able to get things back up. And I'm going to say 8 hours. I don't know the average time for the entire country. I know it was between 4 and 8 hours for a lot of our clients and a lot of the people that I worked with. So yes, it sucked, but that's actually not that bad. You know, it felt like it during the time, a lot of sleepless nights, but you know, it's better than being down for 2 weeks. Like we had one, there's a company that took car dealerships down for weeks because of an attack.
I heard about that. Yeah, it's so funny. Yeah, it's weird. I heard about it, like, oddly enough, talking to like another one of our sponsors, and like their significant other was working in the car dealership industry, and they had to do handwritten contracts.
Yeah.
And, because you're not going to miss a sale if you're in the car business. You're not going to miss that end of month.
Some
sale.
Did though.
I wouldn't sign it. I don't know about you. I wouldn't probably sign a contract if it started faulting, like looking all crazy on the screen,
right?
And things like that. Like, I would go back to my credit union and
exactly. I mean, they lost sales because of it. Some organizations just stopped selling like parts. They couldn't sell parts because they couldn't sell the product. Yeah. I mean, there was a lot of people affected by this. Now, that was, we believe, an attack. You know, I don't want to bring their name up or anything, but it was an attack. We don't know a lot about the attack yet, but they were attacked, but it affected so many people. Yeah. And in that particular case, let's think about this from a broader point of view. In that situation, let's say you couldn't get vehicles or you couldn't get parts. That means machinery was down. That means that fleet vehicles were down, possibly. But if you have fleet vehicles down, which are police vehicles and service vehicles and, you know, all these different things, if they couldn't get parts, their services were down. Those vehicles were down.
Yeah.
That's a problem.
Oh, I mean, we rely heavily on the, you know, as far as the United States, we rely heavily on the, you know, like the road system,
right?
And like trucks.
Oh, yeah.
The annoying trucks are actually doing things.
Yes, exactly.
There. And if they can't go, they're already inhibited by time.
Yep.
If they can't go, it really disturbs us, and we wonder why things, you know, cost more.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, but that one was an attack. Sure. Yeah, understood. They were down for several weeks. Understood. People were affected by it. But I think, you know, kind of going back to your question about incident response, or what you said about incident response, I think something like this really does test your incident response, your disaster recovery, and your business continuity plans. And those three things, people don't generally test. You can absolutely do it by tabletops. And I actually teach a tabletop class.
Oh, yes.
And I help people work through this process. And we have a variety of different types of tabletops. And some of them are very basic. Some of them are very complicated. But I will tell you, there is no tabletop like a actual live scenario that's happening to you right now, because it gets your emotions in play. It gets your physical resources in play. It gets your money in play. Mm-hmm. It's real. And how you react to that. Now, I will say this. If you've got good incident response and good business continuity, this situation was actually fairly easy to deal with. If you didn't deal with it well, if you didn't do with it well, this is the perfect opportunity to take notes and improve your process. Mm-hmm. So if when I say that our system, you know, our client systems were down from 4 to 8 hours, if you had other organizations and they're looking like, you know what, it took us 24 hours to get back up, then my question to you for that organization is, okay, what was successful? What wasn't? What could you do better? How can you build your IR process better to make a situation like this more effective, make in terms of bringing yourself back up? That is the ultimate goal of any tabletop exercise or any incident response, is that after incident report or the after incident debrief, if you go, okay, what worked well?
Yeah.
One of the problems that one of my clients had is they have everything encrypted. They were down. They had everything encrypted with BitLocker. They had to get the BitLocker keys, but the BitLocker keys were stored on a system that was down.
Oh, goodness.
They were very fortunate that they had kind of planned for this sort of thing. They had backups of it. So they went out to their backup strategy and they got the keys. They were able to get in and unlock all the computers, boot into safe mode, delete the file, reboot, get it back up. But they were ready for it. They had it all ready to go. I had a lot of people who were like, we're dead in the water.
Yeah.
We have to start rebuilding.
And so, like, you know, that leads me to our next thing. Yeah. So, like, as far as being prepared for this kind of situation, you would suggest, you know, kind of going through these situations, and if anything that was like missing, try to patch those holes, right?
Oh, absolutely.
In the same breath, I know you probably have to go to the board because you're a CISO.
Yep.
Is this your firepower? Is this how you go there? And you're like,
well, look
what just happened?
Sorry to put you on the seat. No. I mean, this is a valid question, and this is actually something that I talk with other CISOs about when I do CISO mentoring and stuff like that. And here's the deal. You don't ever want to go in and be a fear monger.
Yeah.
You don't ever want to go in and cry wolf. You don't want to ever go in and try to scare everybody. That doesn't mean you don't go in every time there's a situation and tell the board and say, okay, here's what happened. Here's what worked well for us. This is what didn't work. This is my plan for moving forward. This is how I'm going to improve our stuff. So the answer is yes. You will absolutely take this to the board. You will tell them what happened. You will say, this is how we're going to improve this. This is what we're going to change. And this is how we're going to, if this happens in the future, we now have a real life scenario that we can base our processes off of. And then that way, if it does happen in the future, and it will, you're ready to go. Now, one of the things I tell people is when you're doing tabletops, a lot of times people will do one tabletop a year. Bad idea. You should be doing tabletops 4 to 6 times a year. It doesn't have to be a big one, like where you bring in someone like me and we do a formal day and, you know, there's a rapport and there's a process. That's great. And you should do that. But you should also be doing smaller tabletops throughout the year. And you should be testing your processes. You should at least go through every one of your playbooks once a year to make sure that it's got updated information, updated contact information, updated passwords. Passwords are a special thing, so I shouldn't have said that. But you make sure you have all your processes in place. And you should cover, this should be an incident now. This should be an incident that you cover in your tabletop. Maybe in 6 months, you say, all right, everybody, let's pick a software program. Let's say a blah, blah, blah writer now just has a vulnerability and has crashed all their machines. What do we do? And everybody in that room, maybe it's just IT, maybe it's IT and a few extra people. You're just doing a basic scenario driven tabletop, and you go, okay, what do we do? What do you do first? What do you do second? Who do you call? How do you engage them? What information do you collect? You should have all that in your playbook. You should have all in your policies and procedures. You should practice this. Now that you know this can affect you, and it can, you should practice that stuff moving forward.
And do you think that this kind of practice is like should be in-house only type of scenario? Or do you, you know, I've been a part of and I've seen, you know, to where we have like a session at, you know, one of our events type of thing. And you're mixing a lot of different organizations. Is that helpful? How helpful is that kind of thing?
Well,
share secrets.
I think it's different. I say it's helpful because I have done both. I have run tabletops at conferences and with all kinds of different people. I think the biggest one I've ever done is like 350 people or 400 people or something. And that's really hard to run a tabletop, by the way, because you've got you may have 15 different CISOs in the room. You may have 100 CISOs in the room.
Yeah.
That's a lot of type A personalities, by the way. And you're having to run a tabletop like that. So the answer is yes, but it's for different purposes. So when you do a tabletop, if you are involved in a tabletop and you have a good moderator, by the way, they're going to the end result of a tabletop in a broad sense, like at a conference, is you are seeing how other people do things and you're learning from them and you're engaging them and you're getting some ideas or you're providing ideas. I say, well, this is how we do incident command here. This is what we do here. This is what we do here. That's what that sort of tabletop is for learning and training and getting some ideas. When you're doing it in-house, you're actually practicing your processes. You're practicing your incident response. You're practicing your playbooks. You're practicing decisions. Now, for that sort of tabletop, it can be as small as a couple of people in IT get in a room, go to lunch, whatever, and they say, hey, I heard about this attack over here at my other organization. What would we do in that case? That right there is a tabletop. Or it could be a very formal process where you come in, you've got leadership, you got IT, you have business stakeholders, you do a tabletop, you run a scenario that's fairly large, you see how they're going to react, you see how they're, you bring in cyber insurance representatives so they can see how that works. You can bring in law enforcement, you can bring FEMA safety people in. So depending on what you're doing, you're going to, but that is how your processes work within your organization. That's what that's all about. So it's two different things. They're both extremely useful. Having a larger one where you learn from people and having a smaller one within the organization that you're practicing your stuff.
So like fire, what about fire drill style? Like, is that, what do you think that, do you think they should do that? Like, like they do fishing, right? Like I've been caught for like wanting a free cookie or something and like and clicking on the wrong thing and had to go to cybersecurity training, you know, like I'm guilty.
Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, there are some benefits to that stuff. Now I have a live scenario that I do for some organization. I call it a live scenario tabletop. And this would be something where I walk in, I the leadership brings me in with them. So leadership, you know, hires me to come in and do stuff. And then I will plan out a live scenario. And what this usually entails is I will go break something. I might go in and unplug a core and network goes down. And then we will watch how everyone responds. How do they troubleshoot? How do they communicate up the line? How do they get the playbooks? How do they initiate incident command? Now, this is for very mature organizations as it relates to incident response. Yeah. I would not do this. This is not Chaos Monkey. This is for a very specific type of environment, a very mature environment.
Let's say maybe a company like Delta.
Okay, well, Delta is a different issue. Them being down for a long time. Okay, here's the thing about Delta. I don't know all the pieces, but my wife, she used to work for airlines. She did tech support for airlines. Okay. And she actually, we were traveling one day. We were coming through, I don't remember what airport, but we were coming through. And you know those monitors, the big monitors that has all the flights? Well, one of those was down. And she walked up to it, and I walked up to it, and I was interested because it had a Windows or whatever screen on it. But she picked up the phone, and she called someone and says, hey, such and such, I'm at this airport in this terminal, and Terminal 3 is down. And it took them a few minutes, but it rebooted. Well, so what she did was she did dispatch for technical people to go out and fix things at the airlines, you know, the computers at the terminals and whatever. So she knew everyone. She knew who to contact. And that system is very complicated because you're dealing with a digital signage system, sort of. It's kind of a front end to a much larger back end. But those displays are connected. There's a lot of pieces connected on the back end, very distributed, but you're sending a bunch of data to them. It's complicated. I could absolutely see why it took them a long time to come back up for those things. Now, they also had the machines in the terminals and things like that. But what it comes down to is probably, I don't know. I was not there with Delta. They're not one of my clients, so I'm not talking to anyone. But I do know when my wife was doing it, they didn't have the staff. In fact, I remember one night, she worked midnights. So she worked like it from 9 until, I don't know, 6 in the morning or something. I remember waking up and looking over and she was, you know, at the desk working, dispatching people. And but she would dispatch somebody to go fix a computer at a terminal. It would take them 4 hours to drive to that airport.
Yeah.
Because they don't have the staff. I mean, they had a handful of people. And in fact, one of the interesting things, what I found interesting is they would... if a person had to go fix a computer at an airport, let's say they were going to fix it down in Panama, because she covered the Americas, the North and South America. They might drive an hour to Houston, get on a plane and fly to Panama, step off the plane, go fix a problem, jump back on a plane and fly back. That's how they fix those things. Now, we talked about earlier what you had to do on these particular machines, or on these, you had to boot it in a safe mode, delete the file, reboot it. Well, if you've got, let's say, 1,500 terminals down, terminal machines down, and you got 8 people to do this, it takes time. So that would be my guess, just based on my information that I have from my wife when she used to do that and kind of what I saw. I don't know. I mean, I don't work for Delta, but that would be my guess, is it just took time to get people out to there to reboot things, to yank it off there. Now, what I will say this, one of the downsides to this situation is now we know everyone who runs CrowdStrike.
Yeah, that's too bad, right?
So that was a bad situation, but I'm actually glad that they were running a good EDR. You know, that's what I took out of it is, okay, Delta specifically, I'm sure they were running CrowdStrike because they were down during the situation, same blue screen, everything. Yeah, but that means that they were running an EDR. As a CISO, I love that. I love the fact that they're not running some old virus scan, some old, you know, not next gen, you know, endpoint protection of any kind. So even though this was down, even though it caused a lot of chaos and a lot of problems, I'm glad they were running an EDR. I'm glad that they were getting automatic updates. I'm glad because 99% of the time, that is going to protect you. This 1% of it actually hurts you, it sucks. And, you know, it's just, again, it sometimes you just can't get around it.
Yeah. And, okay, so it's been about a week almost. Like, do you think that, like, okay, given the staff or, like, let's call them enterprise-size organizations, they should be up by now, right? I mean, like, are we still blaming anything on that, or what do you think?
I think that there are still some organizations that have machines affected by this this problem, but it's really distributed out now to maybe remote machines. They're hard to get to. Maybe they're low priority. I don't know of any systems at the moment with any of my clients or anyone I talk to that is still down because of this. So hospitals, manufacturing, higher ed, you know, any of those industries that I deal with, the people that I deal with, I don't know of anybody that's down. I do know some people that have just some, you know, this one computer is dead, but the person lives in Amarillo. They're going to ship it here. We're going to fix it and ship it back. Well, okay. Reasonable.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's great. We have Kim. Kim chimed in, and Kim is going to be flying tonight via Delta, and we appreciate it very much that she's listening, and we hope it's going to be fine. Kim, if Delta is having problems, it's not going to be because IT.
Wow, you just put that out there to the computer gods.
Man, Omar. I know. Now that's a soundbite now. I'm so sorry.
Yeah, no. If Kim, I did not say that. So if you get stuck somewhere, it's Omar's fault, not mine.
Yeah, I'm dang it.
No, I really think that most organizations are back up. It was very impactful. It certainly was. I'm not saying it wasn't. Most organizations were up pretty quickly. They were up through the weekend. And many of them are putting some things in place to protect themselves from this happening again. And it's not the things that you think about, like they're not replacing their EDR. They're saying, okay, what do we have to do if we have to touch these machines? What do we have to do to get the BitLocker password? What do we have to do to deploy out these things quickly? That's what they're improving their plans on.
All right. So this is all the physical parts. Like some people were affected and they couldn't do anything about it, right? They had to shut their computer down. Maybe they even got a day off out of it.
Yep.
What about like the psychological impact on these folks? I mean, you're a leader in your organization and, you know, in the cybersecurity, you know, community in general. Like what about the folks who just couldn't, they had to do something, they couldn't do it.
Yeah.
You know, like,
well, what do you think? And I think that there's a couple of factors there. Number one, because everyone thought it was an attack. You know, they thought we were being attacked there in the very beginning. And when it's 4 o'clock in the morning and you're getting woken up, you're an IT system administrator and you don't know why all your machines are blue screen and your services are down, you think it's an attack. You're trying to engage incident response. You don't know. And so that's really stressful. Yes, from an IT side and IT security, it was very stressful because they were trying to recover from it. From a user side, absolutely. This is very impactful. Just think about the airlines. There's people stranded. Now, here's the thing. So I'm working on getting my pilot's license. And thank you. Long time, and it's going to take a lot more time, but I will do it eventually. But one of the things is that even if you lose a computer like this, you know, Windows operating systems, whatever, you should be able to fly the plane. So you should be able to land it safely. I mean, there could be a lot of other issues, you know, electronic problems and whatever, but a computer problem like this, if your computers go down at the terminal, if your computers go down with the, your plane is still functional and you should be able to land. And I want to make sure, because there was a lot of people that were afraid of that literally planes were going to fall out of the sky. So that can be scary, honestly. The other thing is you get stranded. Now I have been stranded at airports. I'll tell you, I got stranded at Dallas. I'm in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and you regularly have to fly down to Dallas to go anywhere else in the world. And I got to Dallas, and I was in Dallas terminal for 18 hours. I was supposed to fly out in 4 hours. That my layover was 4 hours, and I was going to New Orleans for a SANS class. And I got there. One of the flights got canceled. Then we had a tornado, and that bumped everything down. 18 hours I was in the terminal. I eventually was able to get back home. I couldn't get to New Orleans, but I was able to get back home. But one of the interesting things is we couldn't go rent a car. People were trying to go and rent a car, and the rental companies were saying no. Because I could have just driven home in 4 hours.
Yeah, I was going to say that's like not too far. Right?
Yeah, no, it's not very far at all. But they would not let people rent cars because they didn't have enough stock to give everyone a car.
Yeah,
so people were stranded. They felt like they were stranded, and they couldn't do anything about it. So that has a psychological effect. You said earlier about you couldn't get work done. Maybe you had a project you were trying to get done, or maybe you were trying to do. Hospitals were down. They couldn't treat people. That is very impactful. And I think that that's something, you know, and I'm glad you brought that up, because that is a huge thing that people do not take into consideration when they're doing their incident response. Whenever I come into an incident response, the very first question is, can anybody die? If we're dealing with a situation where someone can die, we need to stop and we need to fix that problem. You know, no matter what it is, if somebody can get hurt and die, we need to fix it. But the next thing I think about, and the next question I ask is, how is everybody doing? You know, I ask all the incident response team, the people that we're working with, the leadership, is like, have you eaten? Have you slept? You know, are you in a comfortable spot? I've gone into an incident response because I'm usually, if I go in, which is not my normal job. I mean, my normal job is VCSO, but I do help out on this and I do incident response. But when I go in, I am usually incident commander. So I kind of take over and, you know, put all the pieces in place. But I'll walk in and I'll look at the room. It's like, no, we're not going to be in here. We're going to go into a nice conference room because it'll be a little closet next to the data center or whatever. And it's like, nope, we're going to commandeer. We're going to go into the conference room. We got lots of space, lots of dry erase boards. We got lots of light. We're going to have food brought in.
You got to get like the NASA room with all the like, or the draft room, right? With
absolutely. All the I do incident response rooms. In fact, one of my biggest sleepless in cyber videos I ever did was building the incident response room or the SOC at the university I used to work at. Huge. Everyone loved it. But I thought about all that stuff. How do I treat my people well in this room? How do I give them space and be able to function? Because getting people treated well keeps them going. It keeps them making good decisions. If they're stressed out, if they're emotional. I walked into an incident response and I was talking to one of the systems engineers. And the first thing he said to me, he goes, man, I should have just stopped on the railroad tracks this morning and waited. I'm like, wait a minute. let's take a breath, Let's, let's figure out this problem. It's not that big of a deal. We'll fix it. And we move on. But that emotional thing is really impactful. When you're talking about people that can't do their job and they're mad at IT or they're mad at IT security and whatever, it's real. And that is actually something that you have to put into your tabletops. You have to realize that, because if you don't realize it, there is no way for you to manage that. So I hope people take this as a use case, as a template, and go and do some tabletops in their organizations. All right, how could we have done this better? How do we make sure people are not emotionally, you know, here's the one thing that I saw. One of my organizations, the CEO, the IT security people went and said, hey, yeah, this was a CrowdStrike issue. IT people were mad because it took all their systems down. The help desk was mad because they're getting all the calls. The CEO came in and says, all right, everybody, here's the deal. It happened. Our job is to get it fixed.
Yeah.
Don't worry about blaming. Don't worry about being mad. Let's get everyone up and running. No one's going to get fired. No one is going to lose their job. If you can't do your job, okay, your computers are down. I can't blame you for not being able to go in and send an email when you can't get into your computer. So everyone just go get some coffee, go home, go whatever. We'll get this back up and running. And then we'll come back and we'll clean it up. That is what I felt like was good leadership from these organizations. They understood that, yep, it happened. Yep, we're going to fix it. Yep, we're going to move forward. And we're going to protect our people. So yeah. I think that that's incredibly important. And I hope people learn something from this that they can take back into their organization and make improvements.
So you got to have HR involved.
Absolutely.
This tabletop exercise. You got to have...
Yep.
Like, if it's not the top HR person, it's somebody in there who can really
know HR, what to do. Yeah. HR needs to be part of your incident command structure. I mean, they need to be part of your incident command team. They need to be helping you take care of your people. One of the other things is I don't want any of my incident response team working more than 8 hours. If you're working 10, 15, 20 hours, you're not making good decisions. So the whole point of incident command is you got someone that's in charge, you have everyone has their role, but then you rotate out and it becomes a new person who is coming in and now making decisions, and you log it in your incident log and they know where you're at. They know where everything is. So you can easily switch over management to that other person and they can continue the incident response, because you need people to get some sleep. You need people to get a brain break of what's happening so they can make good decisions.
That is very important. I think especially if you, not even in your, if you're in the IT world, if you just use a computer on a daily basis, I think it's easy to go over that limit. Very much so, especially with remote work or anything like that. You can easily be plugged in for a very long time and bad decisions are made.
Yeah.
You know,
exactly.
And you got to keep that up, especially when it's so critical to your organization.
Right.
So, you know, we have about 10 minutes left. Let's talk about like what can we learn? What can we learn? We know, I know we've already talked about incident response, make sure we have some tabletops and really prepare for this kind of incident. But what else as far as like, you know, mistakes are going to happen. So, you know, besides elbow pads and a helmet, like what else can we do?
Well, first of all, and this goes to maybe CrowdStrike or whoever. And I'm not knocking what happened because I don't know all the pieces, but testing. And it's not just testing of the software, it's testing at the client, at the organization. So a lot of people turn on automatic updates and walk away. And they don't ever think about it again, which is a terrible way of doing it. You need to make sure that you're testing patches, you're testing new softwares, you're doing it in a sandbox, then you're passing it out to a select few machines to see how they work, and then you pass it on further. So if you're doing patch management correctly or update management correctly, if you have a bad patch, hopefully it's only going to affect those things in your sandbox and you're going to know it, and you're going to not send it out. It's possible that a patch or an update comes from the software vendor that's going to take out something unique in your environment. They didn't see it because it's unique. So you have to test yourself. Now, I will say this, the CrowdStrike situation, it would have been very difficult for the organization to have prevented this sort of outage because it was a software update that you couldn't stop. It's not like a DAT file update or anything. It was just really difficult. So it's a unique situation in that. But as a general rule, you should test your updates. You should have a process to test it. You should have someone actually running it. I worked with an organization once. They thought all their patch management was working. When I went and I did an audit of them and I went and logged into their patch management system, no one had logged into it for a year and a half. And it was locked up. So they didn't do any sampling. They didn't log in the system to check it once in a while. So it's like, no. You have to log into this at least every month to pull a report and look at it to make sure, number one, that server is working, make sure patches are going out, find out when patches haven't gone out. And you need to have a checks and balances to make sure the patches have gone out through a vulnerability scanner or whatever. So this organization had not logged into it in a year and a half. It took them almost 2 years to catch up on their updates. They had so many of them out of date that you can't just say, okay, turn them all on because the whole system's going to come down. So manage your patches, test your patches, know how that's going to work, have a reasonable sample size of machines to pass it out to first, and actually check them, let the patch go out, then call them and say, hey, is your machine working today? Great. That's what I needed to know. Then you patch it out to the rest of your organization. Patch management is incredibly important, and people have kind of forgotten that. They just turn on automatic updates and let them run.
Patch Tuesday has gone by the wayside. I mean,
yeah, exactly.
Yeah, big time. Well, Jonathan, we are running out of time here. We only have a few minutes left. Do you have anything you want to share with anybody as far as what you're what are you doing for the next couple of weeks? I know I can tell you what we're going to do soon.
Oh, well, so I've got a few things coming up that I'm really, first of all, DEF CON. For 20 some odd years, I worked in higher education, so I couldn't go anywhere on August because it was blackout. So I was able to go to DEF CON last year, and I get to go back this year, and had a great time, and I'm excited to go back. So I'm hoping that if you have anybody that's listening to this, that if you're going to be at DEF CON, come and find me, because I'd love to shake your hand and talk with you and see how things are going. I've got my tabletops course is actually, I'm going to go teach that at Security Congress for ISC2 in Vegas. Cool. So I'm going to do 2 days of teaching tabletops. It's the same content both days. So, you get one day or you get the other day. But it's teaching people how to do these tabletops. There's 7 or 8 different kinds of tabletops that I teach. I teach you about them and we run through them. I teach you how to build tabletops, how to deploy it in your organization, how to build something from it. If you do a tabletop, what do you get out of it? How do you take that information you get and go and use it to improve your organization? So it's a lot of fun. I taught it last year. I've taught it several times, but I taught it last year at Security Congress. Had a blast. It was apparently the biggest class they'd ever had in terms of people getting to it. I had really good responses from people. They really liked the class. And it really, what I got back from was they never knew how to do a tabletop. They'd heard about it. They kind of did one. They went and got the FEMA ones and they tried them. But there's so many things you can do. There's so much value you can get out of it. So I started teaching this class because I do a lot of them for clients. We have an engagement that's just a tabletop. We come in and we do an engagement full day, all this sort of stuff. So I get to teach other people how to do it. And it's a lot of fun.
Maybe we're going to have you do it at one of our events and like maybe be a session or something on the side or in addition to, we got to talk to Kim about it.
I would love to. I love FutureCon events. Last one I went to was St. Louis and I had a blast. So, awesome. I think, let's see if we can corner Kim into letting me do that.
Yeah. That sounds like a great session, by the way. Yeah. And hey, good luck to your sessions. Good luck to your travel. We're going to take a little bit of a break and be in Salt Lake City on August 15th. I hope if you're in the area, you can join us at FutureCon Salt Lake City, Utah. If not, please chime in when we'll join us again next week. We'll be having another guest, and we love to have you and we love to listen to you. Thank you again for listening to us. FutureCon Cybersecurity will be in a region near you. If you have any questions, please feel free to reach out. Thank you again, and stay safe, America.
Thank you for tuning into And Security for All. Be sure to join your host, Kim Hagem, for another episode of the show next Friday at noon Pacific time and 3 p.m. Eastern time on the Voice America Business Channel. And don't forget, you can follow Kim on LinkedIn by searching for Kim Hagem. That's Kim, H-A-K-I-M, to keep yourself posted on all of her upcoming cybersecurity events. Are you a cybersecurity professional that needs to earn continuing educational hours? FutureCon Events brings high-level cybersecurity training, discovering cutting-edge security approaches, managing risk in the ever-changing threat of the cybersecurity workforce. Cybersecurity is no longer just an IT problem. To learn more about attending a virtual event, go to FutureConEvents.com or email info@FutureConEvents.com. Or follow us on LinkedIn or Twitter at FutureConHQ. Don't miss the weekly FutureCon Seamless podcast series, focusing on the insights and thoughts of chief security officers and industry pioneers making a difference throughout the world. Kim Hagem, CEO of FutureCon Events, and Darren Anderson, CEO and co-founder Next Robotics, host Seamless Podcast, started by a team of entrepreneurs with experience in fields like smart cities, technology, cybersecurity. The result is a series of podcasts unlike anything you've ever heard anywhere. Listen where you get your podcasts, including Apple, Spotify, and Stitcher.